Thanks for clicking play on the Eastlake Tri-Cities Talks podcast. If you're new to this, we're trying to be the best church option for people in the Tri-Cities who aren't typically into church. We hope today's talk inspires you to take next steps in doing life in the way Jesus modeled and taught. If you're ever interested in being a part of one of our in-person gatherings, they take place every Sunday at the Uptown Theater in Richland. Check the website for current times. And regardless of what you look like, who you voted for, or where your tattoos are, we'd love to have you. But for now, here's our most recent talk. Well, hey there. Good morning. Welcome to Eastlake. We're so glad that you're here. Welcome to those of you watching online or on replay as well. We're pumped that you would take time out of your week to do this. We are today on part two of a four-part series called Via Dolorosa. It's a series leading up to Easter. The idea behind the series is simply this. You have people in your life who help you get ready for big days, whether it's a coach trying to get you ready for a big match or a dietitian helping to get you ready for that summer bod or doing something, but people who help you make lifestyle decisions and think about some things differently so that you can approach something better later on with a little bit more of an informed view. And as your pastor, if you call Eastlake home, then this is my attempt to do so for Easter. We're going to get together on Easter. This place is going to be full. There's going to be, eggs in the lobby, taco stands out front. There's going to be talk about resurrection. There's going to be talk about crosses. There's going to be symbology everywhere on social media feeds everywhere. There's going to be quotes and pictures and all the things and words that are said and words that are posted either by you or in response to you or whatever. And oftentimes those words carry meaning and that meaning unfortunately changes over time and that words convey beliefs and words have all kinds of different ways that you can take things and so I want to help kind of work through some of the stuff about when we say what we say about Easter that'd be important because I know that there's been an evolution of thoughts in terms of how words mean things. You can say, I'm a pirate of sort of things. What do you pirate, right? I pirate music, I pirate videos, or I'm a swashbuckler. Those are two different things that are kind of like we're figuring out the terms in which these things come. So what do you mean when you say he's risen? What do you mean when you say he died for my sins? What do you mean when it comes to the central sort of thing with Jesus? Seeming to be one of the central or the central event of Christianity, helping you with some of the dialogue to kind of define these sorts of pieces. So in order to kick things off today, I want to start by reading not from the Bible or scripture like that, but from a different book. This one is called the Iliad, Homer's Iliad. There are two major Greek epic poems that you probably were supposed to read in high school or college, and you never got around to it, and me neither. This is a book I bought years ago, and I was like, I think I want to be someone who owns a library. You ever had that phase in your life where you're like, smart people own libraries? And so I, like you, went to the classic section of Barnes & Noble. It literally says Barnes & Noble on here. I went to the classic section. I think this was like $5.99. And as you can tell by the really refined corners of this book, it has never been fully read. So I own a library. I have this book. I have never fully read this book. I read the other one, The Odyssey, and it was fine. But you get like done reading one of those books, and you're like, that was fine, but that's like a whole different world. It took a long time to get through. I think I'm good on that for like a season. And that season has ended up being about 14 years or so. And so I haven't gotten back into that season where I'm like, I can't wait to dive back into it again. But I want to read just the opening line because like you, I've opened up and tried to start many a book. And this one in particular has an interesting opening line that'll get us going on where we're going to be starting today. This is Homer, again, a Greek epic poem, one of the most popular books. You talk to people who are like, what book, I'm 30 books to read by the age of 30 or, 10 books you have to read before you die, blah, blah, blah. This would be kind of classical sort of literature that's like makes a lot of people's lists, always in stock on Amazon, probably a part of many, many people's libraries, et cetera, et cetera. And it was written about 3,000 years ago. So we're talking pre-Jesus. And I bring that up because I want to iterate the fact that what was the world like if world views and the scenarios in the world inform language about things, then what was the world like when Jesus both came onto the scene, but then even when he died? And does that have anything to do with the way that the early Christians shaped the narrative surrounding what Jesus' death means? Because I think that it does. And so what was that world like? In order to understand that world, you really have to go back and be like, what was going on at that time? and what was prioritized. And this book was one of those things that was around in a big way. Not a lot of literature was in the hands of people at that time. This was one of the first books to ever go viral, right? And they would never, that's a language that we look at. And when we say something's gone viral, that has positive associations with it, right? That means it's blown up and you're not famous or whatever. Back then, viral meant you got the Black Plague and you died. Viral was negative back then, almost entirely. So to say this book went viral, they'd be like, oh, I don't want to touch it. But what I mean is, this one made the rounds. This one did not stay confined within Greek culture. The Romans, when they came in, they took everything good about the Greek culture, especially in terms of education, and they added power to it, and they did their own version of stuff. But this would have been something that most assuredly people in Jesus's time frame would have known about. The world had read this or had heard about this, or the story had been shared. They probably didn't own a copy of it because paper was expensive, writing was expensive. They probably couldn't read it, but the story itself would have been communicated at many different levels. And I think it's important for us to grasp a little bit of that when we go into what does Jesus' death mean for us. So opening, that's a long intro. I'm so sorry. Let's close in prayer and get on our way. I'm just kidding. Here's book one of, and I'm not going to read book one, I'm going to read the opening line of it, but book one, opening line. The wrath-sing goddess of Peleus' son, Achilles. Now, a more readable version of this, because that's kind of a transliteration one, meaning they took the Latin words or the Greek words and they, you know, crossed them off individually, is this. Sing, O goddess, of the anger of Achilles. Sing, O goddess, the anger of Achilles. And the story behind it has been, this book is about, in this translation, the wrath. And wrath is the very first word that shows up in the Greek manuscripts of this text. And wrath is going to be continuously one of the words that is highlighted, used, emphasized throughout the text. The wrath of the gods on humans, the wrath of humans against other humans, the wrath that comes along with, that's a human and divine wrath, sulky wrath, vengeful wrath. A wrath sometimes appeased by sacrifice, a gods who are angry with you. Therefore, you must do something to appease their wrath, sometimes overtaken by an even greater wrath. The entire Iliad is about wrath, the revenge of the Greeks for Paris' snatching of Helen, beautiful Helen, and the multiple secondary vengeful acts between the Greeks and the Trojans. I just saved you, like, I don't know, a year of reading? That's what this book is basically about. A bunch of people who are struggling with wrath and brushing up against it, lingering jealousy, ancient spite, offense easily taken but less easily averted. This is the constant theme of the world's first great viral poem. A bunch of people looking at each other saying, how dare you? And then them going, how dare you? And then we go off and we fight and we do this thing. And how dare you? How dare you say that? How dare you? Just a constant back and forth between I dare you. We dog sat for my sister this last week. My brother-in-law is in the audience today. But we dog sat for their new puppy who's like, I don't know, 6 months old or so. And is just got like puppy energy, right? And we have a 13-year-old dachshund who used to be the puppy. And then her older sister passed away. And so now she's been home. She's been the queen of the home for I don't know how many years on her own. She does her own thing. She sleeps 20 hours a day. She eats, poops, sleeps. That's her life, essentially, is what she does. She loves it. She's content. She's very, very happy. Her tongue slides out of the side of her mouth because she has no teeth to hold it in anymore. And that's just how she lives her life. Her name's Genevieve, and she's great. So we bring this little puppy over into the house. And at first, they're like, you know, doing the whole sniff test and checking each other out and doing this thing. And then like the energy, and we thought there's one of two ways that this could go. This could go, oh, the puppy like inspires the dog to be like, oh, you like dogs that jump around and move a little bit? I can do that. I can be youthy again. Or this puppy constantly trying to get piggyback rides from Genevieve thinking that's what she's there for. And her just constantly, you know, barking at her, yipping at her, squealing at her, doing this thing. And that's the way that it went. It went the way where Genevieve's looking at me with eyeballs like, what have you done? What is going on? And her constant state of wrath against this other puppy, who is the cutest dog ever. And Pete, don't worry, she was fine, beautifully behaved, not her fault. But Genevieve constantly, on the verge of how dare you? How dare you? You jump on my back. You eat my food. You pet my mat. You let my master pet you. You're in the lap. She can jump on the couch. We never let Genevieve on the couch. But Luna's got hops, and so what can you do, right? And so Luna's up on the couch, and Genevieve looking at me like complete betrayal. You let her on the couch? You never let me on the couch. How dare you? The whole week was constantly, how dare you, how dare you, how dare you. Always wrath. Even when it got worse, we would stick Genevieve in our room on her. I'd be like, go to your bed. Go lay down on your own bed. You need to be done. You're out of control, right? She'd go in there and she'd be laying down on the bed, but her eyes, you know where her eyes would be? On that freaking door going, how dare her? She's gonna come through that door. There was never a moment when she was at rest. It was constantly wrath-filled the whole time. And even after she left, and she was gone for like 2 days, she just kept watching the door like she's coming back in. She's just not going potty. It's gonna be a train wreck when she comes back in here. So kill or be killed, eat or be eaten, fight back or get walked on. That's how the world sort of worked back then, in that constant state of always on the verge of wrath. If I'm not engaging in it, I'm anticipating it. If I'm not anticipating it, I'm reacting from it. Wrath, wrath, wrath. If you wanted salvation in this scenario, it always meant being rescued from this kind of thing, from someone or something bigger. All of their stories were epic stories about armies who came in that were bigger. It's kind of like if you've ever watched Lord of the Rings, like the progression between the first one and the third one is the only thing that changes are the armies get bigger. And if it's not the armies that get bigger, it's the orcs that get bigger, or their little things that they create are always just bigger. It's always like, when are we gonna get saved by this bigger army, right? That's how kind of the wrath system sort of works. The Roman equivalent of the Iliad was the Aeneid. And in that, it opens up with this, the opening line of that book is, I sing of arms and the man. Because Rome essentially comes in and adjusts the Greek culture, adopts the Greek culture of education. They love that. They're like, this is good. We advanced in knowledge. You guys are all about wisdom and stuff like that. That's good. But what if you added power to that sort of thing? What if you added, if you took and capitalized on the technology of warfare and added arms to this sort of thing and developed technology to incur debilitating actions on other individuals and other humans at a faster rate and at a more aggressive rate, if you had more impact on this? And essentially, the entire thing about it has always come down to wrath and arms. Wrath and arms. The world in which we have come from, the way the world has evolved, has been in a constant state of wrath and arms. And there's an argument that you could make all that Western civilization has done really is insulate us from the rest of the world that still operates in a wrath and arms sort of scenario. Anger always on the tension side. We watched a documentary this week in our film and theology group here about modern day Russia and Navalny and the guy who's kind of tried to come up and fight against Putin and offer an alternative to Russia, who was then poisoned and killed and all this kind of stuff. And I walked away from that being like, if this is happening today, and it makes you so thankful that you live in America, and sad that this kind of stuff still happens. But it can feel like that's back then. We don't really live in that now. Well, I mean, we're kind of insulated from some of that, but that still very, very much exists in a world dominated by wrath and arms. It just takes more technology advanced to be like, well, now it's nuclear, now it's this, or whatever. But wrath and arms still is a very powerful thing to play. But tacitly and tangibly and definitely at its chorus level, an important piece of the world in which Jesus lived. That was the language of the day, and the Romans were fluent in that language. They had taken the best of Greek, added to it the power of this, and added to wrath and arms, wrath and arms. The message being, he who carries the biggest stick wins. It's no accident that the greatest and the best known poems that were around the world at the time of Jesus and of pagan antiquity begin with these two words. And so I wonder if that's true, and if what I'm trying to do in this series is offer you some options to think through, what do we do with the death of Jesus, and what do we do with this story, and how does this mean anything to you, and what kind of things are involved in the language that you use to kind of describe this sort of thing. Is it any wonder that our atonement theories about why Jesus had to die to appease the wrath of an angry God could potentially be a byproduct of a wrath and arms culture? That if one of the things that we often say is that Jesus had to die to cover up the cost of sin or whatever, in what way and how is this informed by the idea that we've come through and we are surviving and processing through and keeping trying to swim and keep our head above the water in a wrath and arms culture? And I know some people would say, well, God's wrath is a different kind of wrath. It's a holy wrath of some sort. Okay, but let's at least acknowledge that this is the part of the world that this sort of thinking came out of. That it is within the world of the Greeks and the Romans that Jesus was crucified. And I do think he was crucified. And I don't think that this is like a faith thing. I think that historically you would see that there existed a person named Jesus who was crucified. So then it becomes the question of the resurrection. You got to kind of deal with that on your own. But what does it mean? What if we're going to deal with that story and just leave it right there? What is it about that story? What is the context? What's going on in the wider spectrum of things that would help me and help you get the most information to be able to decide what you're going to do with this? It was within that same world of wrath and arms that the originally Jewish message about Jesus received its wider airing and arguably its early shaping on this. Perhaps the question of why did Jesus have to die for my sins or in my place, or how do we understand what this death means for us, is affected by our existence and our mindset of wrath and arms. And maybe this has been the thing that has been such a hard piece for kind of you and me to understand over time about the idea of God and this wrath and arms being like that's been kind of part and parcel of religion in itself and even atonement theories itself. That's kind of pushed me away from this. And Easter's always maybe been a difficult time because you can get behind the Jesus who says, you know, feed your neighbor, and you can get behind the one that says, be kind and love one another. You'll know that people know you're my disciples by the way that you love one another. His willingness to go and reach into the poorest of the poor, the untouchables, and to be able to touch them and heal them and bring humanity into their dehumanized situation. So that's always been sort of inspiring, perhaps, for you. And then it comes to this Easter piece and you're like, I don't know, man. When you hear it, you see, for God so hated the world that he killed his only son. That doesn't sound like good news to you. And it shouldn't. You know what I mean? What's the right one? What's the right phrase? When John sits down and he has a message of hope and love for the world, it's for God so loved the world. He sent his soul, he sent his son to come into this world. And yet sometimes we read this, or it seems like the church in general has a tragic history of being like, God so hated the world, he killed his only son to be able to make this thing right. Last week I said, listen, this is complicated stuff, that there have been centuries and centuries of people trying to make sense of this and trying to clarify what exactly is entangled in all of this. And there's no way that that Brent in a four-part series leading up to Easter 2024 is gonna solve all the problems and tie it on a bow for you. I don't even intend to do so. But what I do intend to do is to say, all right, of all of the common thoughts about the church and the history of the church and what we've thought of how this makes sense for us over the years, what is the common ground with this? Is there anything that like, yeah, everybody would raise their hand and be like, do we believe this? Anybody believe this? And there's two things that we said were critically important that I wanna hold on to deeply. Number one is that his death meant something to the world. Of all the atonement theories of the church, as complicated and complex as they are, if you would say, all right, you know, all the thinkers in the room, do you think that his death meant something to the world? That there was significance about the fact that that person, the embodiment of that way of doing things, was crucified. It means something to the world. I think that most of them would say, yeah, I can sign on for that. And this death meant something in the world, that something changed as a result of that death, that the world looks different because of the death and post the death of Jesus than it did prior to it. And I would think that they would say yes. And that is a concept of the church. Again, you might be more of an agnostic or atheist and be like, I don't agree with both of those things. And that's fine. The premise of the church, though, has been at its core, at its most simplest kind of thing, construction. His death meant something to the world, and it meant something in the world. That something happened as a result of which the world is a different place. And last week I said, I gave you permission, and I wrote permission down, but like, you don't need my permission to believe anything. Like, I give you permission. You'd be like, I don't need your permission, bro. That's the right take on that. So don't do that for me. But I provided space, and I wanted to say, I think Eastlake wants to be a safe place for that to be enough. That we are gonna hold true to something, but this is if that's all it needs to be and you're like, figure out the complexities later of it, that's totally fine. It's better to hold on to love even when we're confused than to let go because we can't understand it. We can engage in a process called faith-seeking understanding. In the same way that in your marriage, there might be some behavioral things that come up with you and your spouse. You're like, I don't understand why you're thinking like this or why you're acting like this currently. I'm gonna choose to love you anyways and we're gonna work this thing out. I'm gonna have faith that you still at your core want this to work. And I'm going to seek to understand why this new version of reality makes sense to you as we go forward with this, all right? So faith, seeking understanding, but at the core, what is it that we hold on to? I think his death meant something to the world. I think it meant something in the world. All right. One of the things that I mentioned in last week that I want to kind of focus a little bit of attention on and spend a little time focusing on is this, that the mode in which he was killed was far more discussed early on than its effect on what it means to be human. If I'm going to give you information to kind of think of and be like, all right, I need to take this into consideration when I hear about the Easter processes, one of the things that you need to remember early on is that in the early stance, in the early response of Christians, either huddled behind locked doors or starting churches and communities, as we see sort of in the epistolic letters of Paul as he's writing to them and encouraging things, what we see is their consternation or their focus on the mode in which he died being of primary or of really high importance versus its effect on what it means to be human. Later on, Paul would come up with some theories and some thoughts on this, and then the church, like centuries later, would have, Anselm's substitutionary atonement, Gustav Allen's sort of Christus Victor, all kinds of stuff. But early on, here's what the church focused on. Can you believe that he died like that? Can you believe he was crucified? Can you believe that he was subjected to that? Someone who meant so much in this way, I genuinely thought he was the one, but messiahs don't get crucified. They might get killed, but they don't get murdered in that way with that sort of a humiliation behind it. It was a scandal to be crucified. And that's the piece I think that sometimes we miss. We assume, you know, death and capital punishment for them was one thing and this was just their mode of doing it. But we fail to recognize the depth in which what kind of a statement is being made by the Romans in doing and exercising this sort of an activity. The Christians seized on this opportunity and identified it as a scandal. Here's what Paul writes about in his letter to the Corinthians, which, by the way, is a letter of like pastoral sort of counseling, not counseling, but outside advising. They're going to come to him with like, we got some issues. We need your help on some things. He's going to say, well, you should work on this, don't work on this, whatever. But early on in that letter, as he's trying to just develop common ground and get buy-in from them, he's kind of talking about what we believe in common. Here's what binds us together. Even though you do church your way and you might not believe all the things that I believe, here's something that common binds us together. Jews look for signs, you see, and Greeks search for wisdom. Right? This is what they're obsessed about. Jews want signs. They want somebody to come in and fix some things because we got a lot of things broken. Greeks search for wisdom, looking for intelligence or a new way to see things. But we announce the crucified Messiah. Here's what the church needs to be about. We announce the crucified Messiah, a scandal to Jewish people. Why is it a scandal to Jewish people? Because in their Holy Scriptures in Deuteronomy, if you hang on a cross, you are the bastardized person of society. You are the person who belongs nowhere. You don't belong in the circle of humanity. You are outside of this. And we reserve that for only, cursed is the person who hangs on a cross. A scandal to the Jews, folly to the Gentiles. Gentiles being non-Jewish people who see this and watch somebody killed in this way, who know that crucifixion is only reserved for slaves and rebels, that there is such a small spot in which a small group of people that need to be exposed to this, it's folly. It doesn't make any sense to them why it would happen in this way. A crucified Messiah, a horrible parody of the kingdom, dreams that many were cherishing. How easy would it have been to tone down for them, for him in this scenario, to tone down the cross bit, to focus instead on resurrection peace or the Holy Spirit or all of the positive things. And yet Paul in his writings cannot stop talking about the scandal of the cross. The scandal of the cross, the scandal of the cross. He had better real estate options otherwise in his arguments, and yet he kept coming back and harping on this idea of the cross. How on earth did something so obviously crazy or scandalous or foolish become so central so quickly? And again, eventually the church would get around to discussing the effect of it. And early church creeds are a bit light on the details, but generally hold one of two values as we go along with this. Two basic kind of pathways, general pathways that you can go in taking, all right, but what does this mean for me? One is that Christ's death overcame the forces of evil. That his death somehow sends a message that you can do your worst and this has nothing, it doesn't affect this, that we are impenetrable, that this is something that is stronger than your worst case against us, or that Christ died in our place. Those are the two most common things. One represented Anselm's sort of substitutionary atonement sort of thing. And this is the one that has been probably the most popular, that Christ died in our place. And there's a way in which, okay, what does that mean? How is that true? And that's where it gets a little bit tricky because it can kind of come sort of feel like a little bit problematic. Because many people have pointed out that the idea of an angry, bullying deity who has to be appeased, to be bought off, to have his wrathful way with someone, even if it isn't the right person, fits uncomfortably well with the way many human authority figures actually behave. Tyrants, rulers, bosses, terrible dads, perhaps clergy members, be like, died in our place. I'm so angry at you, I'm gonna take it out on him. Like, what does that mean for this guy? That sucks for them. Like, what's the point of this? How does punishing them in that way help me out? You would say, or people with victims of abuse long-term would see this version of the church saying, this is what the crucifixion means for us, and be like, I don't know, man. That doesn't sound like love to me. That feels like an abusive sort of situation. I know that character, I hate him. And it doesn't do any good to tell people in that state of mind that this angry God is really a loving God in disguise. People who would say and respond rightfully so, if that's love, then count me out. It's not uncommon for an abuser to say, I'm doing this because I love you. Leading N.T. Wright, one of my favorite quotes from this book that I've been going through with this, you cannot rescue someone from the scars of an abusive upbringing and replaying the same narrative on a cosmic scale and mouthing the word love as you do so. But this is sort of love. So even if we do agree that somewhere perhaps in the middle of overcoming the forces of evil or Christ died in our place, or if both of those things are generally true, but there's ways of interpreting those words, I think one of the key things to remember about in terms of which one and which pathway are you gonna lean towards, or is you're gonna be somewhere in the middle where you get kind of both of those pieces, but that's kind of the general direction of it. I think what's most critical or a piece to keep in mind in light of this is both of those options came as a result of being in the world and are informed by activity of living and breathing and being involved in a world that is obsessed with wrath and arms. That we believe that this story happened in history, that this text didn't float down to us as a core of it. It's a bunch of people over a long length of time, different viewpoints, different perspective, human fingerprints all over the place, trying to tell their version of the story, inspired by God, absolutely. And I think over facilitating the entire process, 100%. But still a world that they don't know. There's a guy who used to talk about asking a goldfish, how's the water that day? And they're like, what's water? Like when you don't know that you're involved in something, you don't know what the absence of it would be. When you're involved in a world of wrath and arms, the fact that your language and your history and the things that you come up with as solutions to really complex scenarios has to do with wrath and arms is understandable because that's the world that existed at that time. And if we believe it happened in history, there's no wonder that it shows up in this way. The world of wrath and arms helped to explain why anyone would want to execute a fellow human being in so brutal a fashion too. The idea behind capital punishment has always been a deterrent, right? And crucifixion is nothing more than the ultimate human deterrent of behavior. While humane capital punishment may be an oxymoron, that's a topic for another Sunday, we'll get to it at some point, we can all agree, and everyone can agree, that there is such a thing as an inhumane capital punishment, right? Crucifixion would be exactly that. It was an attempt to deliberately show people who is in charge, to break the power of resistance, again, reserved for slaves and rebels. And it's highlighted every year, the darkness and the depth of what crucifixion involved, and movies are made about it. Passion of the Christ, right? You watch that and you're like, I remember watching that. Everybody watches that movie once. I've never heard of anybody that's like, I can't wait to watch that again. You know what I mean? You watch it once and you're like, I think I'm good, right? Rightfully so. It's dark. It's awful. And there would be some that would say, yeah, but I mean, we read about terrible things happening to humans all the time. The depths at which humans can treat another person. Worse things have been done to humans, no doubt, but typically in secrecy and void of social systemic support structures. We say things like, can you believe that that happened? That was a mentally deranged episode from that person to be able to do this. Like those are one-offs. We look at those things and be like, that's terrible. It's awful. It's awful. And we would rightfully say that person needs rehabilitated in a controlled setting to kind of rehumanize him and bring him back into the fold, right? But what we're talking about with crucifixion is state-funded, state-operated, state-sanctioned, state-supported. Yes, this is good. This is okay. This is what we do. Gather the crowds in. We're going to do this public execution on this thing. Kind of like, you know, French Revolution did this with the guillotine. This is a popular get the crowds together. This is what everything wants. And yet in the guillotine fashion, it's over quickly, right? In this section, in this operational thing, state sanction and agony and torment and torture seem to be its primary function. Crucifixion was the end result of a wrath and arms driven nation who had experimented for decades with zero human rights ethics on the brain. There are no watchdogs going, I don't think we should do this. With the sole intent purpose of how do we make this even worse? Imagine for decades, no holds barred, state sanctioned, how do we make this worse experience for those who are going through this? The Romans did not invent crucifixion, but they did adopt it very quickly. And you could make an argument that they perfected it. It's one of the most horrible fates humans could devise. And that's not a modern overstatement by any means. Roman orator Cicero and both the Jewish historian Josephus, who had both seen with their eyes and experienced these things, would go on to write about the depth and the grossness of this product of centuries of dehumanization and public humiliation and shame and pain and torment and agony. They would be flabbergasted at the fact that we wear crosses around our neck and on the walls of our house only because we've never experienced one in real lives. They would say that they're the things that nightmares are made out of, memories of humans half alive, half dead, lingering on perhaps for days on end, covered in flies and maggots and blood, nibbled by rats, pecked at by crows, with weeping but helpless relatives still keeping watch. Which would lead Cicero to one time write about this and kind of like a brace against this in humanity. Not even saying it doesn't belong here, but recognize the grotesqueness of the nature of it. The term crucifixion should be far removed, not only from the person of a Roman citizen, but from his thoughts, his eyes, and his ears. For it is not the only, the actual occurrence of these things or the endurance of them, but liability to them, the expectation, indeed the very mention of them, that is unworthy of a Roman citizen and a free man. He's like, when you go down that road, when you see that enacted, when you see somebody experiencing that, when you commit to being a part of the crucifixion of somebody else, it does something in your brain and in your soul. The dehumanizing factor involved in this does something to you. He's like, this is bad. This is beyond terrible, awful. It was the worst way someone could die, which is why it's so incredible that Paul in his letter to the Philippian church would say this: in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by being obedient to death, even death on a cross. He would go on to finish this. It's kind of like this unique poem. If you opened up your Bibles, if you brought a Bible, you would see that this portion of his writing would be indented, meaning that many theologians believe that this would have been one of the songs or part of a creed that some of the early church would sing as they gathered together. The early church didn't have services and buildings like we do today. Sunday was a work day. It was the first day of the work week. Saturday was their Sabbath. They would get together on Sunday mornings. They would share breakfast together. They would sing perhaps a few songs, a few creedal things. They would talk about each other. They would find out what's going on in each other's life. They would encourage each other not to be thieves, not to steal, to be faithful to their spouse, to not commit adultery, to pray for one another, to hear about, you know, your daughter's turning how old? That's incredible. What's going on in life? And then they would leave. It was like, you think about that like a small group. That's what the church essentially was. But of some of the songs that they would sing, there's a few that Paul seems to write about in a way that shows that even before scripture made it on the scenes, that these were the things that we knew. That somebody somewhere came up with this bit of theology, and early on we adopted this and it became part and parcel of what we do when we gather together on Sunday mornings. Almost as if as he's writing this, the first chapter of his letter to the Philippian church would have been new information to the church. But at this point, everybody in the audience who would have heard whoever read this letter out loud, which was how this would have transpired, would have begun mouthing the words from the audience as it's being read, because we all know what this says. And then listen to this flow. Listen to what he's doing this. This is going to reflect kind of a downward trend of sort of the experience of what it means to be human. or Jesus's Jesus' experience as a human in your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature of God. Here's what I want you to do. If you're up here, if you start up here, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, went down on this. Rather, he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. That's as low as it gets. He humbled himself. He did this. He's trying to say, listen, in a world of wrath and arms where everything is telling you to be strong, to come back fighter and being bigger and better than the next thing, where your life is supposed to look like this. It's this, and then it's this, and then it's this, and then it's this. He's going, no. The pathway that Jesus showed us is this. It's downwards. And it ends at the depth of, in the worst and most unlikely way that somebody could potentially die. This is the most degrading, dehumanizing process involved in this thing. And that's the path that I want you to have. It's an incredible sort of thing. Crucifying people beside busy roads or by the entrances to a city was, of course, designed to make a statement, to issue a warning. If you've ever toyed with the idea of not playing along with us, of joining a revolt, look at this, and maybe you'll come to see that even your present miserable life looks better than this. No doubt authorities would often tell themselves that this was the only language such people understood, dehumanizing them even in that process. There seems to be two, historically, two major accounts of mass crucifixions taking place. One happened pre-Jesus and one happens post-Jesus. When Pompey comes into Palestine and the early conquest of that before it became kind of a Roman province, he would crucify the rebels. He posted them up along the street side to kind of send a message. We are Rome, welcome to our kingdom, right? We preach peace and prosperity, but at the expense of whatever else is involved in this. And then later on in AD 70, when Tiberius would send his grandson in to kind of come in and settle things down, because Jerusalem was just enough on the outskirts of the Roman Empire to be like a thorn in their side, and they had just enough religious weirdness to be like, we don't buy along with everything that's going on here. We're gonna kind of do our own thing. It was like a tinderbox of constant revolution. Judas Maccabeus at one point, and just always kind of whether we're gonna side with Egypt or gonna do this, it was kind of complicated territory for them. And eventually they got tired of putting up with it. Pontius Pilate was there to kind of keep peace and to kind of make sure that nothing happened. And that's why he's trying to be like, you know, what am I gonna do? Barabbas or Jesus? What do you want from me? Whatever's the least amount of conflict to be avoided. That's what the goal was. And so at some point then, in AD 70, the Romans had enough. And they're like, we're just gonna come in and just destroy everything. They destroy the temple. They kill a bunch of Jews. They lay siege on Jerusalem. And they do a mass crucifixion again. Thousands of people along the streets to kind of send another message. This is what happens when you disobey. We are fluent in the language of wrath and arms. Don't tempt us. Don't tease us. Don't toy with us. Play along or else. Now, the irony of all of that is the message that they preached, that when the gospel or the good news of Caesar Augustus goes out into the world, we have great news for all mankind. A savior of the world has been born and the government will be upon his shoulders. He is a prince of peace, right? All familiar language that later on Christians would adopt for the announcements of Jesus, but these would be the birth announcements of Augustus, who brings the world peace. Rome was all about peace. Their big message was peace. On the underside and the flip side, how they got the business done was force. It was always wrath and arms. The message is peace. The means is always wrath and arms in all of this. The social meaning of a crucifixion was then to communicate in words and in deeds, we are superior, you are inferior. Political meaning, we are in charge here, you and your nation count for nothing. And the theological meaning is that your gods, whatever they may be, will allow you to do whatever you want, as long as it doesn't interfere with taxes and believing in respect for authority and honor or whatever. Your gods cannot help you here. So as Jesus of Nazareth hung dying that Friday afternoon, all of those meetings would have been deeply intuited and understood by everybody there. Roman soldiers, women, disgraced disciples behind locked doors. And by 6 in the evening on the first Good Friday, according to the early Christians, the world was a different place, that something had happened in the world and something had happened to the world. In light of what we know about that crucifixion and what we know about the message it was trying to send and all of the things involved in that, then the question becomes to us, what was different? Why did they think it was different? What was different? What was different and why was it different? What was it different and why was it different? And lastly, and how might that revolutionary difference challenge us today, summoning us to our own vocation as followers of the shameful, scandalous, crucified Christ? If for Paul and the early church, this thing was such a scandal, may that resonate with us as we go through this period of Good Friday leading up to Easter, that in the process of understanding what is the beauty that Easter provides us with, it's the day that the revolution is, it's the first day of the new revolution, it's the first day of the new world, it's the first expression of the new world, it's something that has changed in the world, something happened to the world and in the world through the death of Christ. But what does that mean? Those are great questions. And I think it's only until we understand the depth and the darkness of what's involved in the crucifixion, both in the way that it died, but the message that it sends to a world obsessed with wrath and arms, to a person who embodied everything in the opposite of that, and the overcoming that is involved in that. And that's what we'll talk about on Easter.
Thanks again for listening. If you've got more questions about the church or community group options for connecting with Eastlakers outside of Sunday mornings, I'd encourage you to check out our website, eastlaketricities.com, or better yet, download our app by searching Eastlake Tri-Cities in your favorite app store.